The Old Testament reading is from Genesis 39. Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had brought him from the Ishmaelites, who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him and made him an overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge. And because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eye on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in this house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her, or to be with her. But one day when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out in a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house." As soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, "This is the way your servant treated me," his anger was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. The epistle reading is from Hebrews 12. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood." The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Matthew.
Glory to you, Lord Christ.
Woe to the world for temptations to sin, for it is necessary that temptations come. But woe to the one by whom the temptations comes. And if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than with two hands or two feet to be thrown into the eternal fire. If your eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into the hell of fire. The Gospel of the Lord. Praise be to you, Lord Christ.
Well, good morning. Thank you for being with us here this morning at All Saints. Pray with me, if you will. Father in heaven, we thank you for your kindness and love and goodness towards us. We pray this morning as we dip into your word, as we hear from you, that the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be pleasing and acceptable to you, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Well, this morning we have a passage from Genesis 39, which on the face of it, I think we can all agree, has to do with temptation. And perhaps an iconic image for all of us about temptation. If you've read the Odyssey, I went to a classical Christian school growing up, so of course reading the Odyssey was standard fare for us during the summer. And There's that iconic passage in the Odyssey where Ulysses or Odysseus is in his ship sailing home, and he has to pass by the island of the Sirens. And the Sirens are these temptresses, these beautiful creatures that sing songs and lure unwary sailors into what they think is going to help, but ends up crashing them upon the rocks. And the way that Odysseus deals with it is he gets beeswax, he gets some information, he takes beeswax, he puts the beeswax into the ears of his sailors, but Odysseus wants to hear the song of the sirens. And so what he does is he goes to the mast of a ship, and he has his sailors strap him down and tie him to the mast of the ship. And while they sail through, Odysseus is so overcome by the temptation of the sirens and the songs that he's writhing and shaking and trying to get off the mast and cutting himself with the very ropes. But his sailors, because they can't hear it, are not tempted, and his ship actually gets through. And I had this moment of what I like to call Pandora serendipity while I was thinking about this. You know what Pandora is, the music listening app? So Pandora serendipity is when you're thinking about something, you have a certain mood, and you're listening to Pandora, you know, internet radio, and a song comes on that is exactly about the thing you're thinking about or whatever the mood is that you're in. And so this happened to me. I was thinking about Odysseus and temptation, and a song came on that was really a sort of a modern version, maybe a more visceral version of temptation. It's a song called SOB by Nathaniel Ratliff and the Night Sweats. So I don't know if you know this song, but it's sort of Americana, sort of vintage R&B. And Nathaniel Ratliff, the lead singer, he's singing a song really that's about temptation, and especially in regards to alcohol. And this is the way it starts. It starts very kind of calmly. He says, I'm going to need someone to help me. I'm going to need somebody's hand. I'm going to need someone to hold me down. I'm going to need someone to care. Then it kind of starts to escalate in the second verse. I'm going to writhe and shake my body. I'll start pulling out my hair. And then when the chorus breaks out, it's a full-on sort of symphony of noise and frustration. He says, SOB, give me a drink. Just one more night. This can't be me. If I can't get clean, I'm going to drink my life away. It's a captivating song, but it's not really pretty. But it's honest, I think, in many ways, for anyone who's ever tried to break an addiction or in the throes of temptation, whatever the temptation is, that sense of, I need help. I'm writhing around. I'm breaking at my bonds like Ulysses, cutting myself, trying to get free, resisting the temptation. And this morning, temptation is something that we all know. If you're 3 years old or you're 80 years old, it's an experience. If you're a Christian or a non-Christian, we know what temptation is, what it feels like. And this morning in this passage, which so obviously is about temptation in many ways, I just want to ask two questions. The first is, what is the temptation here in Genesis 39? And the second is, how do we handle our temptations? So the first question, what is the temptation here? Seems like kind of a weird, odd question, isn't it? I mean, isn't it pretty obvious? It's just sex, right? We've got clothes being ripped off. We've got a handsome Joseph. We've got Potiphar's wife in the throes of desire, sort of commanding Joseph to have sex with her. I mean, it's something straight out of HBO, right? Or isn't this the temptation? It's just have sex or don't. It doesn't just reduce to that. But I think our passage here in Genesis 39 is really helpful. It forces us to expand that and grasp, helps us really to grasp what is the biblical sex ethic. Because in a passage here that's so kind of overwhelmed with questions of illicit sex, we really need to deal with the topic of sex, I think. And here's why. Sometimes I think we've been given the picture in Christianity that Christianity is anti-sex. It's really kind of all about rules for when you can do the physical act and when you can't, right? It's sort of this very narrow, reduced, negative vision of sexuality. It's really just about the sex act. And really, that's an incredibly reductionistic view of sex. If you want to get a handle on the biblical sex ethic, you'll have to see that Joseph's problem here and how he responds to Potiphar's wife's seduction isn't first, hey, if I have sex with you, that will break a rule. Of course, that's true, but that's not the first thing that he says. In fact, if you look at verse 8, Joseph appeals not to sort of a law or a rule or breaking that, but he appeals first to an issue of justice and fairness. He says, look at all that your husband has given to me. You're the only thing he's kept back. His implication is for me to engage with sex with you, to take what hasn't been given to me is unjust. In other words, whether or not I have sex with you is more than do I want to? Do you want to? Are we consenting? Is anyone else going to get hurt if we do what we want to do? Notice that what Joseph is putting up here is roadblocks to the temptation, the seduction, is more than just a moral question, although that's there. But he's also putting up ethical roadblocks and social roadblocks. You know, look, I have all these responsibilities in this house. What will happen to that responsibility? In questions of justice, in fact, if you look at the bigger arc of what's going on here, if you were here a couple weeks ago and Josh Eby gave a sermon on Genesis chapter 38. And Genesis 38 is also a text that has a lot to do with sex. But the questions that are being asked about sex in connection with here are bigger than just, is it right or is it wrong? They're questions about, will God fulfill the promise that he made to Abraham? Is the line of Abraham going to die out? Is Judah in Genesis 38, is he losing his own children? Is he now going to become a Canaanite, and are the people of God going to be dispersed? And that same question is being asked here of Judah. Is he going to become an Egyptian? What's going to happen to the people of God? So you've got historical questions that Joseph is dealing with. You've got social, ethical, justice questions. It's more than just the physical act of sex. In fact, what Joseph is saying here, what he's resisting, is really something very similar to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. If you know that passage, Paul actually alludes to this very story there when he says, flee from sexual immorality in the same way that Joseph here flees from the seduction of Potiphar's wife. You see, Paul there in 1 Corinthians 6 is saying, do not have sexual relations, he's talking to the Corinthians, with cultic prostitutes, because his argument is that in sex, more than just our bodies are being joined together. It's an entwining of two persons' lives. Two and everything within two lives are made one. Which, as many people have pointed out, isn't an anti-sex position at all. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It makes sex of great significance. What Paul's doing and Joseph's reaction is because sex is sacred. What Paul is getting at and what Joseph uses to resist is the necessity of really sexual integrity. In other words, let me just say it this way. You can't unravel the body and you can't unravel sex from the rest of life. Ronald Rollheiser, many of you have maybe read him. There's a book that he wrote called Holy Longing. And in the book, I think this quote I'm going to read to you, he addresses it this way. He says, sex, by its very nature, speaks of total giving, total trust, and total commitment. There is an unconditionality inherent in so intimate a sharing of one's soul. Thus, if real trust, commitment, permanency, and unconditionality are not present within the wider relationship, then sex is partly a lie. It pretends to give a gift that doesn't really give, and it asks for a gift that it cannot respectfully give back. In other words, it says, I want to consume all of you, but I won't trust you with all of myself. And interestingly, what that tells us about sex is that it's not the end direction of life in which we're going, but really it's a part that tells us about all of life. And for this passage in Genesis 39, Joseph's temptation here is perhaps located in sex. Those are the, you know, the defining characteristics of the temptation. But the temptation is some temptation that's just common to all of us in every aspect of life. Because it's the root of all sin, ultimately, is making everyone and everything pour itself out for us, making it orbit around ourselves while we take and take and don't give anything back in return. In other words, all temptations are really temptations to disordered loves, to one-way love, where things love us, but I don't love in return. So, to illustrate, like if you're tempted towards violence, the temptation is you hurt and you die so that I live and thrive. If it's greed, you wither away so I can grow fat. If it's envy, you lose your place so I can get it. If you're tempted towards sloth, it's you do all the work so I get the reward. If it's pride, I above all, whatever the cost to you. See, in a biblical ethic of sex, you can't unravel sex from the rest of everything else in life. It's a part of life. And as a side note, really, this should be really freeing for us, especially if you're not married. Because often what we are told is that sex is the direction, the end, one of the virtues of life itself. But what the Bible is telling us is that, you know what? It's not. It's not the point of life. It is just one aspect of life. A fundamental reality of our characters, but not the fundamental reality of our personalities. So it needs to be shaped and molded like any part of our characteristics. Because we often hear, right, in the undercurrents of our culture and our imagination that you aren't fulfilled. You aren't a complete person unless you're having sex. Like that something is wrong with you if you're a 40-year-old virgin, right? Or you're in a funk. And if you're in a funk, it's because, well, you haven't gotten any recently. And once you do, you'll be happy and smiling. And you're hurting deep inside. You know, you're a Don Draper. Don Draper is just, his problem is that he hasn't found the compatible sexual partner yet. And he's always looking. And in many ways, that's sort of the argument that Freud has given us, which is that all of our spiritual longings, the brokenness and the ache inside of our hearts, are really just suppressed sexual desires. But the biblical argument is exactly the opposite. That all of Don Draper's desires, that Potiphar's wife's desires, that all of our desires, sexual desires inside, are really just suppressed spiritual desires. The problem is not, which is often told, I think, to us in the Christian church, the problem is not that our sex lives aren't okay. The problem actually is that our lives aren't okay. That our lives and the loves of our lives are all disordered. And because of that, our sexual lives are also out of order. In fact, it's you notice that the temptation that Joseph experiences here in verse 8, and the way that he handles it, is really the same temptation that Adam and Eve have in Genesis 3. Right? The temptation that Adam and Eve have, and that serpent gave to Adam and Eve, was that, look, God has given you all this stuff except for this one tree. And so you know what that means? God's withholding on you. He doesn't love you. He doesn't care for you. And Eve uses that as a justification to give in to the temptation. But you notice here that Joseph uses that exact same logic the other way around. He says, Potiphar's given me everything except for this one thing. Eve says, well, then I need that one thing. Joseph says, how could I take that one thing? Joseph really escapes this temptation because the loves of his life are ordered correctly. So we see, he loves Potiphar well, he loves God well, and he escapes. Now, I know in saying all of this, really this leaves us, many of us, sort of aching feelings of guilt. Because far too often, who we are not the Josephs who run, right? We're the Josephs who stay. We're the Potiphar's wives. And I want you to know that I'm not trying to make you feel guilty this morning. I'm really not. Really what I'm trying to do is convince you that the biblical sex ethic is actually more life-giving. It's more whole. It's not reduced to one thing. There's more going on here than we often think. It's powerful precisely because it isn't unraveled from the rest of life. But we would be sort of left in guilt if we didn't see who Joseph is pointing to in this passage. Do you realize that everything that happens in Joseph in this chapter in Genesis 39 is reminiscent for us, ultimately, of another descendant of Abraham? Because at this point in Genesis, what's happening is God made a promise to Abraham that eventually he would bless the world through his descendants. And as we're coming to the end of Genesis, we're coming to the end of the patriarchal age, God is beginning to bring that promise to fruition. Because if you know the rest of the story of Joseph, you know that what ends up happening is Joseph becomes a blessing to the world. He saves Egypt, he saves the people of God, he saves the world from famine. He becomes a redeemer. But first, he is convicted unrighteously. And he is numbered among the transgressors, right? That's what happens. He's thrown into prison. He's named a criminal. But only through that, he becomes a redeemer. And there's another descendant of Abraham who's also numbered among the transgressors, who also suffered unjustly, though he was righteous. And our passage from the New Testament from Hebrews 12 reminds us of who that descendant is. He was the one who resisted temptation, even to the point of shedding his own blood, his very life. Why? To redeem you? Yes. To restore you? Yes. To make you pure? But notice in verse 2 of chapter 12, Hebrews chapter 12, it's for the joy of having you. That is the joy that Christ had of knowing you and having you is what enabled him to resist temptation and pour his life away for you. In a moment here, when we come to this table, Christ will give his body to us. But it won't be a demand like Potiphar's wife demanding that Joseph give his body away for her. And it won't be reduced to sort of some physical act. Because when Jesus gives his body away for us and to us, and to the bride of his church, it is with the entire weight of his whole life, commitment and love behind it. We are made one with him and undergirded with his promise that he will be with us even to the end of the age, that he will make us holy and blameless. Yes, even the Josephs who don't run. Yes, those who are not confident of their sexual integrity. Because he gives his whole life to us, to unite us to himself, to make us one with himself, so that we can come into the presence of God, holy and blameless, proclaiming Christ's love for us. He resisted temptation, not because it was wrong to do, though it was, but because he loved you. Do you know that? That's why we're called in Hebrews 12 to lay aside every weight and sin that weighs it down. And that's why Jesus, in the gospel passage, treats sin so severely. Because to him, we are the prize, worthy of resisting all temptation, even to the point of the cross. And he says the same to us. I am the prize to you, worthy of resisting all temptation. I am the very thing, in fact, that all of your desires are ultimately pointing to. And I'm the only one who can truly satisfy you. So, that really brings us to our last question. Because we've dealt with the first question. What is a temptation? It's really disordered loves. So how do we handle our own temptations? And I think this passage really helpfully illustrates three things for us. First, notice in verse 9 here that Joseph sees that his sin would be both against Potiphar, obviously, but ultimately the very last thing he says is, how can I do this great wickedness against God? In other words, Joseph takes his temptation and he doesn't leave it down here at this level. He takes it up to the ultimate level, to the highest level. So I think often when we're tempted, what we tend to do is say, as long as no one finds out, right? As long as no one gets hurt. And Joseph reminds himself that even if Potiphar never finds out, it would still be a wickedness against God. It would still be a sin because ultimately all our disordered loves towards others and towards other things, towards other people, begin first with a disordered love toward God. That's what we've been saying. Secondly, so first, to resist temptation, we need to realize who it is, ultimately, that our loves need to be directed to. Second, there's just the simple sort of principle of fleeing, of running. And here are two things. One, I think it's sometimes we associate fleeing or running with sort of an act of cowardice. Like, I'm running away. I don't have the strength to do it. I got to get away. But I think we've actually got that completely backwards. Joseph is not fleeing because his will is weak, but really because it's strong. A weak will is the one who stays because it wants to be broken. The strong will knows when it has to run away and has the power to run. Because secondly, do you know what Joseph is doing here in this passage? If you look at verse 10, notice that Joseph is really practicing this habit of fleeing. He's building the will of fleeing. Notice at the end of verse 10 here, he says he didn't listen to her. In other words, he fled from her words. He didn't lie down on the bed with her. He didn't fantasize or indulge. He didn't put himself in the practice of thinking about what it would be like. He didn't even spend any time around her. He was building the self-will, the habit really of fleeing. Why? So when Potiphar's wife is grabbing at him and throwing herself at him, he was able to run. And I think it's interesting because I think that's often the opposite of how we deal with temptation. There's this kind of anecdotal story about a mother who told her son, she said, "Son, after school, I don't want you to go play baseball. I want you to come home right away because we have stuff to do." And so then the mother then sees the son as he's going off to school, and he's got his baseball glove in the back of his backpack. And she says, "Why do you have your baseball glove?" And he goes, "Well, just in case I get tempted." And yeah, the idea is like, well, I'm going to just toe this line and see how close I get. In other words, I'm building the habit of temptation. I'm not building the habit of resistance or fleeing temptation. Joseph, in other words, is always walking forward to a higher love. He's not running from something as much as he's running to something. And ultimately, that's what's going on. If you back up in verse 8, in this story, what Joseph is doing is he's focusing not so much on what he doesn't have, Potiphar's wife, but what he does. So it's not so much a focus of resistance as going to something that he loves. His meditation is upon Potiphar's goodness and grace to him. I think the question is, how often are we prone to, in our lives, meditate on what's not been given to us, what we don't have? Are we being consistent in being thankful or consistent in being discontent? So I think to resist temptation, all the disordered loves of our life, we have to do as Joseph does and begin with thankfulness and gratitude, recalling all that God has given to us, recalling that we are united to him and all that Christ has given away that we might be his. Because like Christ in Hebrews 12, the only thing that can compel us away from sin, any kind of sin, and toward him is a higher love, a desire, a joy that can draw us away to something more. So, to close, just another song about Ulysses. This one, though, is by Josh Garrels. And here are the lines of the second verse. I just want to read them to you. He says, "Trouble has beset my ways, and wicked winds have blown. Sirens call my name. They say they'll ease my pain, then break me on the stones. But true love is the burden that will carry me back home, carry me with the memories of the beauty I have known. I'm sailing home to you, I won't be long. By the light of the moon, I will press on." What Josh is saying, what I'm saying, I'm also named Josh, is that, friends, may the unfathomable love of Christ dwell in you. May he be the joy and the beauty that will carry you past the siren's call to bring you safely home and to reorder your loves so that you resist temptation not by an act of the will within you, but by running to a greater desire, a greater love. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.